Hello, and welcome to The Big Snore. In each episode, I will read a passage from a book, an article, a magazine that runs about 15 to 20 minutes. You can choose to listen to this as a bedtime story or just a story at any time of the day. Today, the passage I'm reading is from Sarah Polley's book, Run Towards the Danger. When my third child, Amy, is 9 weeks old, I have a dream. In the dream, I'm walking on a beach in Prince Edward Island. Eve, who is 6 years old at this time, holds my hand. The white sand stretches beyond us into the distance, where the beach melts into soft dunes, long grass growing precariously off the edges and swaying gently in the breeze. The sun is shining, the sky an impossible periwinkle blue. Eve looks up at me with a face full of joy. Later in the day, we find ourselves in a narrow hallway in a dark, claustrophobic hotel and decide we were better off outside. Later in the dream, we go to a red sand beach. The sun is hot and orange and lower in the sky. I can't make out where the sand and cliffs end and where the boiling, menacing sky begins. My child is still beside me, but with a heavier expression. Eve is not exactly unhappy, but we both feel trepidation now. The feeling of uninhibited freedom we had on the first beach is gone. We are both conscious that our togetherness has an added importance and weight now that our surroundings have abandoned their previous perfection. I hear the words, dissolve the boundaries, over and over again. When I wake up from the dream, I say to my husband David, I wish we could go to PEI. If we could get on a plane right now, I would. As soon as the words escape my mouth, I realize what is going to happen. This is the kind of far-fetched wish that David hears as a challenge. Let's do it, he says. He goes to his computer, and despite my half-hearted protests that he be practical, he figures out a way to get us to Prince Edward Island the next day, through two connecting flights on points. This plan to jump on a plane to PEI the very next day makes no sense. David begins his first position as a professor at a law school next week, after almost a decade of work on a doctorate. We are sitting in mountains of laundry from a car trip up north that we returned from just last night. And we have a plan for every day of the next week before our two oldest children begin their school year. This is exactly the kind of squishy scenario that David sees as an opportunity to prove we are alive by doing the most irrational, spontaneous thing possible. He has always been romantic like this since we first met briefly when we were 14 years old. It's one of the most thrilling things about him, and it can create a kind of havoc that I sometimes struggle to enjoy. I send off apologetic emails to friends and begin the brain-jamming process of packing for five people. We have a tiny new baby, we've never traveled with all three children, and we have other plans. This isn't like me, to go along with a spontaneous plan like this. I usually like to rehearse, in my mind, all the possible ways things could go wrong when we travel. When we go anywhere, in fact. But I know that we should go on this trip. There isn't a doubt in my mind. I feel uncomfortable admitting that this uncharacteristic certainty I am in possession of is owing to the dream I've had. I've been paying attention to my dreams lately. After 20 years in psychoanalysis and psychotherapy, I'm used to noticing them. They're smoke signals from the past drawing my attention to burned-out wreckage in a distant forest of the mind, packed and buried under years of debris, still smoldering. But lately, I've also started to see dreams as guides, pointing the way forward. A dream brought us this third child, who lies beside me now. As I imagine writing this, a newborn nursing through the night, opening her eyes occasionally, sensing it is not a day yet, and then going back to sleep. We had made a firm decision a couple of years ago not to have a third child. The two children we already had were full of energy and challenges to our endurance. But one night, I had a dream that a beautiful little baby named Amy watched us walk from her small cot in a hospital room, wondering who we were and why we had to leave her behind. I woke up crying nonsensically that we couldn't leave baby Amy, and now Amy's here. And the energy we lacked before we have somehow mustered, and the frenetic energy of our older two children has been quelled somewhat. Amy has calmed us all down and made us all superstitious. While we may have been cynical before, now we try to read the stars, knowing what they brought us. I take a break from packing for the trip to PEI and check my email. A friend has sent me a link to a new posting from the CBC archives entitled "When PEI Welcomed Road to Avonlea's Sarah Polley." I shudder both at the memory and at the eerie coincidence of her sending this to me now, just as we have decided to go to the island. I watch the clip, an almost 30-year-old news item, about my visit there to promote the TV show I was in, which was based on some of Lucy Maud Montgomery's books, including The Story Girl. At the time, it was the highest-rated show in Canada, topping Hockey Night in Canada. I was often recognized when I walked down the street, on my way to school, or out with friends. I found it agonizing. From the age of 10 onward, I tried to avoid being noticed. When I was a teenager, my desire to disappear became even more pronounced. I wore baggy clothes, hunched myself over, and kept my eyes firmly on the ground. For the most part, this never really changed. I avoided groups of adolescent girls especially, groups of wholesome-looking girls, homeschooled, virtuous, or overly innocent, were sure to be fans of the show and would ask me for autographs. Groups of girls like me, cynical, brutally honest, uncompromising, would be sure to laugh at me. Many times, I'd pass a group of girls on a busy street in downtown Toronto, notice I had caught their attention, and quicken my pace. "Sarah," I'd hear, yelled from a distance. I'd turn around and they would laugh. I didn't blame them particularly. It's what I would have done at that age. But it smarted to be so intensely associated with something that didn't represent anything about who I was. By grade 8, the precocious kids at the art school I attended had long since stopped being impressed that I was in a television show. My boyfriend, who wore a cape, fashioned himself as a kind of suburban Jim Morrison, and was playing Hamlet in scene studies, said to me one day, "Someone asked me the other day if I thought you were a good actor, and I said, I don't really think I've ever seen Sarah act." The activity that took up every waking hour I had for 8 months of the year was not thought of as acting by my peers. It was just an embarrassment. When I was in grade 9, one of the grade 12 students asked if I would take part in a skit for the school assembly. It was thrilling, being called upon by one of the older, cool kids. The day before the assembly, I was informed that the skit was entitled "The Top 10 Things About Going to Earl Haig Secondary School." I would be number 10, and when I appeared on stage, the plan was for a bunch of kids in the audience to throw peanuts at me. I pretended I was sick the next day to avoid the humiliation, and I was later berated for letting down the student council. These weren't traumatic events, and as I look them over now, they read like a list of minor sob stories. I tell these stories only to illustrate that it was not modesty or a tendency towards shyness that made me uninterested in fame at the time. The notoriety I received for the show I was in actually humiliated me. I stare at the CBC footage of my childhood visit to PEI. I'm 12 years old. I look tired. "She confesses it's tiring," the voiceover says. I look tired in almost every interview I gave as a child. I say the right things, the nice things I'm supposed to say, but I can see in my eyes a weariness, a wateriness, and a sense of betrayal. As the CBC clip says, the crowds built all weekend. Everywhere I went, there were hordes of people. I participated in some kind of parade where I sat alone in the rumble seat of an old-fashioned convertible and waved at the crowds. I sat in shopping malls for hours as people lined up for my autograph. I would look up and see them hanging over the balconies and nauseously try to calculate how long it would be before they would reach me. I gave readings at Green Gables, the fictional home of Anne. Busloads of tourists crowded in to hear me read passages from The Story Girl, the book upon which the series was based, and get autographs. There were always questions from the audience, and once a little boy asked, "How come on the show you look so pretty and now you don't?" I tried to laugh it off and come up with a witty answer. Before I could, the publicist, who was also my guardian for the duration of the trip, leaned over and whispered into my ear, "Makeup. Say it's because of makeup." This is the answer I gave and instantly felt bad about. One day, the publicity team took me to a beach so I could have a break between the press obligations. I took a long walk by myself, taking in the extraordinary expanses of undeveloped white beach in Cavendish. There were lots of people there that day, sunbathing, splashing in the waves, and building sandcastles with their kids. When I had almost reached the far end of the beach, I heard a shuffling noise behind me. Many of the people I had passed on my walk had risen and followed me like silent zombies. I've told this story a few times in my life. When people ask me if I've ever been to the island, I've always been sure while telling it, or the stories of the crowded autograph sessions and the parade, that I have been exaggerating somewhat. Surely it wasn't that big a deal. Surely there weren't that many people following me. I exaggerated a lot when I was a child, and as a result, I have a sometimes fatal mistrust of my own memories, which leads me to interrogate them fiercely. As the years go on, I now veer towards minimizing things, and I've always felt sure the trip to PEI could not have been as overwhelming as I remembered it. But when I watch the CBC footage, I realize, with some dismay, that I have not been exaggerating. One segment of the clip is in fact called PEI Fans Follow Sarah Polly Around the Island. I felt like a circus animal in those days, a curiosity trotted out to make other people's children happy, while I lived in a house that was in constant squalor, motherless, and often working 13 to 15 hour days. While that period of my life was not a happy one generally, the PEI press tour, as I tried half-heartedly to appear innocent and happy and in the midst of a perfect Edwardian childhood, stands out as particularly cringeworthy in my memory. And now, strangely, I want to go back. I've had a dream, followed by the strange coincidence of this footage coming my way. I write a post on Facebook asking friends if they have any recommendations of places to stay in Prince Edward Island. My friend Jackie private messages me, "You're going to PEI? Really? Won't that be kind of irritating?" I make a joke about being too old and haggard after having three children to be recognized anymore. She says she doubts it, and deep down, I do too. When we check in for our flight, the attendant behind the desk takes our passports. Eve yelps, "We're going to PEI." "The birthplace of Canada," the attendant says, smiling without looking up. Eve looks up at me. "What does that mean?" "He means Confederation." "It's where Canada was born," he says as he cheerfully affixes the tags to our luggage. He widens his eyes at Eve, trying to elicit excitement. "The birthplace of our nation." "So Canada was born there?" Eve says, looking up at me, confused. "How does a country get born?" "Well, a bunch of white dudes sat around a table. They decided there would be a country. They decided there would be a Canada. That's what it means." "You can decide to get born?" As in all of these big question conversations with Eve, I know my answers will be inadequate. I know I will do my best. I know that later on, I'll have moments of regretting both what I have said and what I haven't said. And it is the great privilege of my life to be invited into these conversations at all. I'm conscious of not wanting to shatter the image of a good world that can only really exist in a lucky, privileged childhood. But I also feel it is important to be as honest and thoughtful as I can. Any other strategy would be a failure now anyway. At 6, Eve is already starting to sense hypocrisy, falsity, and exaggeration. Once, as I yelped and applauded, a somersault Ilo was showing me, Eve said, "That reaction you're having on the outside isn't the same as the one you're having on the inside." So when Eve asks me, while David is checking us in, "Was Canada being born a good thing?" I try to find the truth of what I believe in a nanosecond. Find words for that truth that Eve will understand while juggling three bags, a crying newborn strapped to my chest, and a three-year-old who keeps attempting to bolt for the security lineup. I used to think it was only good because it was important for us to try to rely on each other and not the United States, but now I know that Canada was really, really bad for a lot of people, especially Indigenous people. I can see in my peripheral vision that I'm getting a frosty look from the check-in attendant. I've seen that look before. When people love their country, they don't like to hear it criticized. He stops interacting with us as he prints out our tickets and hands them to us without looking up. As we near the security gate, Eve eyes the uniformed personnel nervously. Eve is obsessed with the idea that at any moment an arrest might be in store, and always tenses up around people in uniform. A small finger beckons me to bend down to ear level. There's a whisper in my ear. You know how you were a little bit, or almost kind of famous from TV and movies? I'm taken aback. At this juncture in our lives, I don't have the sense that Eve is aware of this at all. I stopped acting years ago and stopped directing films when I started having kids. Eve and Isla know that I acted when I was young and are vaguely aware that I wrote and directed films in the past, but they've really only known me as a stay-at-home mother or a mother who writes while they're in school. Eve must have heard this from someone at school, maybe a teacher. I feel a flash of unease as I consider this. Sort of, yeah, I respond. Well, Eve says, grinning a little, keeping focused eyes on the security person. That would be a really good excuse to not get arrested if you got in trouble for something. On the plane, the baby mercifully sleeps. Eve is obsessed with making new friends and sits in the row across the aisle from us, engaging a teenaged girl in constant conversation. When I suggest that the new friend may want to relax and sleep, Eve gives me a yes sergeant flick of the hand, an officious nod, opens an Ivy plus Bean book, and begins reading out loud in a full voice. I'm not sure this provides any kind of respite for the teenager in the next seat, but there's not much I can do from two seats away. Isla watches Peppa Pig on the small screen attached to the seat in front of her, and I contemplate how to talk to the kids about the fact that I will be known in PEI. People will stop us on the street. It may be confusing to them, and I want them to be somewhat prepared. I seem to have to learn over and over again that whatever problems I prepare my children for will always be a little to the left or right of where the problem actually lies, and the problems I'm anxious about will generally turn out to be fine. The real problems are almost always surprises that can't be prepared for. I decide not to say anything. As we disembark at the tiny airport in Charlottetown, we walk down the metal stairs from the plane and onto the tarmac. I keep a firm grip on both of my older children's hands while a baby stays asleep in her carrier. David manages the bags behind us. As we enter the airport, we see a small crowd of people looking expectantly at the passengers, anxious to catch a glimpse of the person they're here to take home. I smile and I'm surprised to find myself trying to make friendly eye contact with anyone and everyone. I think, subconsciously, I may be trying to remedy the grumpiness I always displayed as a child when I was recognized. Many times, I've had adults my age tell me how rude I was to them when they recognized me as a child on the street. I somehow feel now that I should make up for that. It has always made me feel guilty to think that I wrecked other kids' days back then by not being the happy, romantic girl they saw on TV. But any reconciliation on that front between my imagined public and me is impossible, because not one person recognizes me. I stand and wait for our luggage, taking in this unexpected turn of events, as David goes to change the baby's diaper and even Isla climb the giant shiny cow's ice cream cow statue. Isla is singing, "There's no people like show people, they smile when they are low." She sings loudly out of the corner of her mouth. It creates a 40s movie star effect. She's somewhere between Ethel Merman and Mae West in her mannerisms. A few people look over at her, laughing as they collect their luggage. My friend Rick taught Isla this song as a joke. "It suits her perfectly," he said, smiling at me. All my friends know that my worst nightmare would be to have one of my children become a child performer. That was a passage from Sarah Polley's book, Run Towards the Danger. You've been listening to The Big Snore. Thank you for joining us for this episode. Until next time.